Well, good morning. I'm Dan Reed, one of the pastors here at CPC. It is a privilege to be part of your celebration this morning. Thank you, team, for leading us. It's great. Thanks. So I'm going to date myself here a little. There was a movie that was out probably 25 years ago describing an event that took place 45 years ago. And some of you will remember this name, Jim Lovell. He's truly an American hero. He's also an American astronaut, and he was in charge in 1970 of the Apollo 13 space voyage, which was a mission to land men on the moon, but with a malfunction in the electrical as they were in orbit around the moon, what happened was it turned into a rescue mission to bring those guys back. And you see the brilliance of these engineers at NASA pulling this together to bring them home. Well, my favorite scene in the movie is actually not a scene where they're in the spacecraft orbiting. It's a scene where we are seeing on TV an interview where a reporter interviewed him on the most scariest time he's ever had, being a pilot in the cockpit of a fighter jet. You'll notice, again, dating myself, you notice the television set on this video is about the size of a couch. And I think it's a Zenith. We had a Zenith, and it was great. We were the hit on the block because we had a Zenith. And the hairstyles, I think I remember my mom having a hairstyle like that. Let's watch it.
Apollo 13 Commander Jim Lovell has more time in space, almost 24 days already, than any other man. And I asked him recently if he ever was scared.
Oh, well, I've had an engine flame out a few times in an aircraft and was kind of curious as to whether it was going to light up again, things of that nature. But they seem to work out.
Is there a specific instance in an airplane emergency when you can recall fear?
Well, I tell you, I remember this one time. I'm in a Banshee at night in combat condition, so there's no running lights on the carrier. It was the Shangri-La, and we were in the Sea of Japan, and my radar had jammed. And my homing signal was gone because somebody in Japan was actually using the same frequency. And so it was leading me away from where I was supposed to be. And I'm looking down at a big black ocean. So I flip on my map light. And then suddenly, zap, everything shorts out right there in my cockpit. All my instruments are gone, my lights are gone, and I can't even tell now what my altitude is. I know I'm running out of fuel, so I'm thinking about ditching in the ocean. And I look down there, and then in the darkness, there's this green trail. It's like a long carpet that's just laid out right beneath me, and it was the algae, right? It was that phosphorescent stuff that gets churned up in the wake of a big ship, and it was just leading me home. And now, if my cockpit lights hadn't shorted out, there's no way I'd have ever been able to see that. So, you never know what events are going to transpire to get you home.
So Lovell speaks in his book about the hand of God on his life. But you'll notice in here in the story, he calls himself lucky. And I call him blessed, that luck doesn't have anything to do with it, that God has a plan, and his fingerprints, as we see it revealed, are showing all over that plan. So you think about this. You think, well, he ran out of fuel. He was running out of fuel over this big, black, dark ocean. His navigation was scrambled. Instruments were going dark. And in that darkness, a bright green trail formed that he would not have seen had the instruments not gone dark. And that glowing, frothy green glow led him home to his aircraft carrier. As Christians, we believe that God is sovereign. That means we believe that he has authority and that nothing happens in which that's not part of his ultimate bigger plan. We believe that no circumstance happens by chance. We believe that there's no action that's random. And when I look in my inner world or I look out at my outer world and I see bad things or I see ugly things and I wonder why, I've learned over the years that God has no obligation. I don't have to know the entire script. He has no obligation to read to me the last page of this drama that's playing out in my life and around me. And I've learned that I won't always be able to connect the dots to see the full picture. But he's taught me to trust in Romans 8:28 that God works out all things according to his purposes for his ultimate glory. So I see also within this plan that God has, that he's involving me in, he always provides me space or a place for my human responsibility to be engaged in that plan. This place for me to take the right actions, to take the right actions on faith that also contribute to his ultimate glory on earth and in heaven. So in this video this morning, a question comes up is, what if Lovell wasn't highly trained, highly skilled, where a well-prepared pilot? Would he have been able to keep his cool under such circumstances? What if Lovell wasn't at least somewhat familiar with marine biology to the point that he could recognize algae, and then when it's churned up, it's frothy it glows. Yeah, phosphorescent. Yeah, whatever it is. Okay. Anyway, glows a lot. So if he didn't understand that, how would he be able to make it home? So every circumstance in my life, I recognize God's sovereignty at work, and I also recognize God's plan, my responsibility to act on faith. So the fact remains, for all of us here, whether we're looking in our inner world, whether we're looking outside in the world around us, some of you may feel today like you're in a big, dark, black seat, that you're running out of fuel, that your navigation lights are out, and that you're flying blind. And the truth is that God makes a provision for every broken wall, every broken world. He leads us, he teaches us, he instills in us a call to rebuild, and he also provides for us a way to rebuild. And it may not be the way that you've rehearsed over and over again in your mind of how it ought to be. As you laid it out, this would be the perfect scenario, God, to solve this. But it's his way, and it's for his ultimate glory. Last week here, many of you identified your broken world because you connected with Nehemiah and you connected with his prayer. And as Rob led through that text, you were compelled to grieve. You were compelled to cry out to God. You were compelled to pray for your broken world. And you were compelled to even write out your prayer, write out your cry to God and put it on that paper and slip it into the crevices within this wall. And you left this place with hope that God's working. And today, as we move to Nehemiah chapter 2, we're compelled by Nehemiah's story to stay persistent in prayers for our broken world, whether it be something internally or something out there that God has burdened you with. But we're also to pray with this inner confidence, knowing that even if there's a black ocean with map lights and navigation out, God will lead you home. And you're compelled to pray and ask God for wisdom. Wisdom is to recognize that green trail when it appears that will take you home. Pray for skill to know that there's personal responsibility in this, that we must tilt the controls. We must skillfully guide as God gives us that space to trust him and act on faith. And with that faith, we know we must pray for strength and courage because it's scary to step out. And God asks us to step out on faith and trust and have the courage to be a part of rebuilding that broken world. So when God calls us to do something, he'll open the necessary doors, but we must be willing to step out in faith. So what is required to find that path that leads us home? First of all, as we see, it requires patience. What actually was Nehemiah's prayer in chapter 1? Nehemiah specifically prayed that God would change the king's heart, that king who he served, Artaxerxes. It was like this: Lord, I ask you to change the heart of the king, change his attitudes, change the situation so that I may be allowed to do your will with the boss's favor. So what happened right after Nehemiah started praying? What happened the next day? Nothing. Nothing that we visibly see or know about. Nothing that's obvious. Nothing. Not right away. Nothing happened. So as we look at chapter 2 now in verse 1, we get some insight into this. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So we're now in this month of Nisan, which is April. And if you remember from last time, when the story began in Nehemiah, it was the month of Kislev, which was December. So 4 months have transpired. So when Nehemiah began to pray, the next day, the next week, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, nothing is happening. Have you ever had that experience? If you committed to pray, wait, nothing's going on. It can be very disillusioning. But a person of prayer, a person is called to serve the Lord, must develop the discipline of patience. Why does God require patience? Because patience, it goes against everything in our humanity, which is telling us when we see something broken, we got to fix it. We got to jump out. God, if you're not going to take the lead, I'm going to take the lead. Just come in and support me in this. Because we want to get that solved. But what God wants us to do is focus on, wait a minute. I'm the one in control. You can't fix this. I must fix this. I need to lead. And this building and waiting, this patience, gives God an opportunity to show that he's powerful in this situation, that it's all about him. So he lays his problem before God for up to 4 months and counting. And then it says, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and I gave it to the king. So what are we supposed to do while we're being patient? Well, we pray, and then we follow Nehemiah's example here. And what does he do? He continues to serve. He continues to live his life. He continues to fulfill his responsibility. To change the heart of his supervisor, which was his prayer, Nehemiah needed to do his job well. He needed to take that wine, he needed to sample it, and he needed to serve the king. So do you think Nehemiah was sometimes distracted in his work by this burden that he was carrying? Probably. Do you think there were times when Nehemiah was depressed in this four-month period? Most likely. Was he tired and weary? And you think, as he's persisting in this prayer and fasting? Quite likely. But he still showed up. And he still did his work. And while we wait for God's answer, until our orders change, continue to serve. That's the example of Nehemiah. So he continues to write in his journal, I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. Did you catch that? Nehemiah had not been sad in his presence before. That internal struggle hadn't shown up on his exterior up until that point where it began now to affect his outer appearance. And this king very perceptively noticed this. Well, a little background here. The number one rule when you're serving the king in Nehemiah's culture here is don't be a Debbie Downer. The king doesn't want to hear your negativity. Don't bring that king down with your problems. You are to put on a happy face. The king's court worked like a dysfunctional family. Don't share what you're really feeling here in the presence of the king. But the burden that Nehemiah carried was too big to hide. So he put his career, if not his life, in jeopardy by being honest and transparent. And what was showing on the outside was reflecting what was going on the inside. So to find this frothy green glow of a path to take us home, it requires patience. But now we're going to see it requires something else here that Nehemiah gives us that we need to know, and that's courage. Nehemiah, in verse 2, he writes, I was very much afraid. So I think Nehemiah, in this persistent prayer, and seeking the courage to trust God, as he let his guard down, he's seeing, man, I am taking a risk here. And not only that, Nehemiah's praying. I mean, he's hoping, he's imagining, he's rehearsing. If I ever have the opportunity, how am I going to respond to this king? And God allowed the king, the only one on earth that could help him, that had the resources to help him to rebuild Jerusalem, the walls around Jerusalem, he knew that he needed to reveal himself to this king. So this moment had to arrive. It had to have been surreal. It was really happening. He was scared to death, but at the same time, being scared to death, he knew how to respond. Listen, look at the wisdom here. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Those were his first words. I love this loyalty, this humility. He cares. He cares about his supervisor. He cares about his job. He has this great reputation. And then he goes to the real issue. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Did you catch what he didn't say here? He didn't say Jerusalem. And as you dig deeper into the reason why, it's likely that the king's advisors over in the region of Judah there had sent a notice to the king saying, hey, these guys are starting to rebuild the city. And we know from history that if they rebuild this city, your tax revenues are going to go down. They're not going to pay their taxes. And so you need to stop this wall from being built. And Artaxerxes from afar, way off in Susa, said, you're right, I need tax money, so I'm going to stop this. So in a sense here, Artaxerxes is responsible for these walls not being built that Nehemiah is going to ask Artaxerxes for help to rebuild. So instead of appealing to this, which would probably put both of them in an awkward position, he instead appeals to the culture of the Middle East, and he looks into this notion of their ancestors. Leaders in Middle East cultures, it's all always about, where are my ancestors buried? Is that area being being honored? Is it being taken care of? We don't want that in ruins. So that's how he appealed here. And it was a brilliant, God-given strategy to keep this process going. And he was able to say it clearly and respectfully, and all the while being scared to death. And then here's the question. The king said to me, what is it that you want? I mean, listen to that. The king of the world at this point, with all the wealth and power of his kingdom, was wrapped up into that question, what is it that you want? Someone said this, success comes when 1,000 hours of preparation meet one moment of opportunity. And here was Nehemiah's moment of opportunity. The door was swinging open. And after 4 months, he's beginning to see that green glow forming in the dark ocean. So we see his patience and we see his courage. And then what we see is something on his internal. It always comes back to this. Every time when we see God work, we see prayer. We saw it for those 4 months, and we see it right now. What does he say, the last part of verse 4? Then I prayed to the God of heaven. Right there, before the king, he shot up a prayer. What do you might call it? A text prayer, an arrow prayer, an SOS prayer, a 911 prayer. He shot it up there. But this prayer was not, he didn't go through his life not praying for those 4 months. This prayer was backed up by 4 months of prayer. It shows us that Nehemiah walked with God because he was talking with God on a regular basis. And this was just the cherry. It was just all part of who he was, the foundation of all that was going on. Well, last week, God led us at CPC to talk to God, to place our prayers before him. And you guys did it with this wall here. And your challenge, and my challenge, was to keep on walking with God, to keep on talking with God. And through all of this, Nehemiah continues to see. And as we consider how rebuilding must go on in our broken world, he continues to see himself as dependent upon God in the exact place he needs to be to see the wall rebuilt. So if you remember, God brought his brother to him to give a report about Jerusalem. And that report disturbed him. It grieved him. It broke his heart. It gave him prayers like God, break my heart for what breaks yours. And then it led him to pray. And then he's weeping and fasting and praying. And when he does that, then he expresses how great God is. And then while focusing on how great and awesome and holy God is, he's convicted of his own sin and his own wickedness. And he cries out to God in confession. And then he owns his own sin. And then he prays boldly to God, asking for help, trusting in the promises of God and how God has delivered his people in the past. And as Nehemiah takes this deep breath, he throws up this 9/11 prayer. He turns to the king, realizing that this is my opportunity to be used by God. This is the place where faith and trust and planning coexist for the glory of God. So we see now preparation. It's been said, those who fail to plan, plan to fail. So we see that Nehemiah was not just a prayer, he was a planner. And it's just spilling out here for us to see. As we read these next verses, we're going to see that the step of his plan. First, convince the king to allow him to leave his service in order to rebuild the wall in this city that the king had stopped the rebuilding of the wall prior, back in Ezra chapter 4. So he answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight," that's the answer to his prayer, the king's favor, "let him send me." That implication of sending me is the second step of his plan. The fact that Nehemiah was asking to be sent means that Nehemiah's plan was to convince the king to lend financial support to the project. Nehemiah didn't have any money. It wasn't just cut me loose, king, but your plan, my plan, God, your plan, God, this needs to be funded. How's it going to happen? He let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. And then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take? And when will you get back?" You see what that's reflecting? It just shows how much they care for Nehemiah, that he's got such a great relationship with him. And you catch that. It's interesting. In his journal, he made sure to mention that the queen was sitting next. So you think that queen had a relationship with Nehemiah too, and they both loved him. And I've heard it said, you know, the husband may be the head, but the wife is the neck. So you wonder what she said to him that turned him or pushed him or got him to that point of being able to release him to go and be a part of God's work. "It pleases the king to send me, so I set a time of my return." They wanted him back. And then step three of the plan, it's all about, okay, I got to travel there and I'm going through some hostile territory. I'm going to need letters that are going to show me that I can get through here without being stopped or are arrested. "So I also said to him," as this plan was formulating over the 4 months, "if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah." There's another interesting historical fact that comes out here is that the guys that were in this Trans-Euphrates region were the ones in the first place who told Artaxerxes not to let the Jews build the walls. So no wonder Nehemiah is asking for special permission to be protected from Israel's enemies. And then as his plan had formulated over those 4 months of prayer, and then may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. Remember, he's never seen Jerusalem. He is pulling all this together in his mind. Maybe he had some maps, but he had conversations of how it would look. And he's able to articulate this plan. So what's step four? Work out a deal with this Asaph guy. He's the keeper of the king's forest. He's got to give me the timber so all this can be done. Have you ever thought about the fact that God honors faith and he also honors order and organization? There's the old Revolutionary War soldier who used to say, "Trust in God, but keep your powder dry. Pray to God, but make your plans. Set your sights. Think through the hurdles." And you imagine if Nehemiah hadn't planned ahead, and as he left Susa with this entourage, and he's going on, he runs into the first border, and they ask him at the border, "Where are you going, cupbearer?" "Well, I'm going to Jerusalem." "Okay, well, where are your letters for passage?" I don't have any letters." "Well, you can't pass." So he has to go back to the king. He planned. He prepared. And then you picture him approaching these Trans-Euphrates guys. "Hey, here's the letter from the king." "Well, okay, Artaxerxes, it's right there." "Okay, go ahead, go on through." He goes through enemy territory because he has the right letter. Or he comes across Asaph's territory. You can imagine Asaph is probably a pretty tight, much of a tightwad with all this great timber that they have to be used in the king's service. "Hey, you're going to need a requisition for that, Nehemiah." "Hey, I have it right here. Here's my requisition, signed by Artaxerxes." "Well, let me see that. Let me make sure." "Okay, take your timber." This isn't luck. This isn't random chance. This is God answering Nehemiah's prayer. Now let's look at the final scripture this morning, the last part of verse 8. "And because the gracious hand of my God was on me," I could just see him pinning this with a smile on his face, "the king granted my requests." From Artaxerxes, Nehemiah hears what? He hears the word granted. "I grant you your requests." I think of Proverbs chapter 21, verse 1. Solomon says, "In the Lord's hand is the king's heart, and it's a stream of water that he channels toward all who please him." So Nehemiah is now able to connect the dots. He's now able to see that frothy green glow of God's pathway home. And he sees his responsibility. It was to wait patiently. It was to continue to serve. It was to show courage. It was to pray. It was to prepare until God opens up the door of opportunity. And he sees God's divine hand governing and directing all of this. And theologians have a term for this. They call this divine providence. What is divine providence? Divine providence means that God, yes, he's in complete control of all things, and that he governs and directs all things in the universe, whether they are our own personal situations as outlined by what's in these walls, or whether it's things in the universe. He governs and directs these things, and he governs and directs these things all with this. And this is the most, to me, this is the crux of the providence of God. He governs and directs these things with wisdom and with love and with care, all for his ultimate glory. And we believe that the ultimate glory of God is when broken worlds are rebuilt. Whether it's in our inner world or whether it's out there, some kind of unfairness, some kind of injustice, some kind of abuse that you just look at and say, "I'm not going to tolerate this anymore. I've got to see change. This just disturbs me too much. I've got to do something." I'm able to look at where things are now and I see a vision for how things could be. And I realize that if I don't do it, who will? So my story that I want to share as I was processing through this. And we've been living in a condominium in San Mateo for just about a year now. And one of the things that I've been praying for is the opportunity to meet and serve my neighbors in that condominium. If you've lived in condominiums, you know people come and go really quick, and it's not conducive to having people stand around in front yards and talk. And so being able to build those relationships. I have some wonderful relationships in the last year and a half that I've been at CPC, but 99% of them are within the walls of CPC. And I know God's calling me, and I don't have young kids anymore. I can't use my kids' sports as a way to connect. There's got to be new and creative ways. So I hear 4 months ago that there's an opening on the condo board. Anybody ever served on a condo board? And I really prayed about that. And what will this mean to be on the condo board? So I felt a green light to go forward on that, and I campaigned, and I gave speeches and hung signs and ended up running unopposed. No, I didn't hang signs or give speeches, but I was brought on to the board, and I thought, man, Nehemiah's example here, pray for these opportunities, continue to serve. How can I serve on this board? One of the other guys on the board said, you're a pastor? Yeah. He goes, well, maybe you could be part of peacemaking amongst us here. You know, I don't know. I hope so. And continuing to serve until God gives that crack and that opportunity. Well, a couple of weeks ago, one of the board members and I met for coffee early, very early in the lobby. And we just had coffee, just got to know each other and turn to conversations about spiritual things, and then Jesus coming into those conversations. I think, God, thank you. As I see this frothy, glowing path open up to God and the opportunities here. And that was my prayer. That's what I put on my card. It was about my outer world and making a difference in my outer world as a follower of Christ in the Bay Area. So God is faithful. We can trust Him in all of these things. And I'd like you to just leave you with this picture. And I'd like you to bow your heads and close your eyes as I kind of paint this picture through this story of as we look at our lives and maybe still think, man, I am in this dark, over this dark, dark sea. I am looking for that glowing path to follow that I know comes from God. So one tribe of Native Americans, they had a unique practice of training their young braves. On the night of the boy's 13th birthday, he was placed in a dense forest to spend the entire night alone. Until then, he had never been away from the security of his family and his tribe, but on this night, he was blindfolded and taken miles away. And when he took off the blindfold, he was in the middle of thick woods by himself, all night long. Every time a twig snapped, he probably visualized a wild animal ready to pounce. Every time an animal howled, he imagined a wolf leaping out of the darkness. Every time the wind blew, he wondered, what more sinister sound is it masking? No doubt it was a terrifying night. After what looked like an eternity, the first rays of sunlight entered the interior of the forest. Looking around, the boy saw flowers and trees and the outline of a path. And then, to his utter astonishment, he beheld the figure of a man standing just a few feet away, armed with a bow and an arrow. It was the boy's father. He had been there all night long. Can we think of any better way to glorify God than through facing these faith tests of life? And knowing that God is always present with us, glowing like a green carpet path on a dark sea, unseen for a while, but as we lean into Him, waiting, continuing to serve, being patient, being prayerful, planning, showing courage, that our Father's presence is more real than life itself. Let's respond in worship. Thank you.